All right, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off. We left off in the chapter 18 of 2 Samuel. And, of course, this is the time where David is on the run. He's fleeing from his son Absalom. And before we get into this chapter 18, I just want to kind of back up to the last few verses of chapter 17. Matter of fact, back up to verse 24 of 17 so we kind of get into the flow and the flavor of where we're headed, because some people weren't here when we started this book, and especially this particular episode in David's life. And it says, "Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan, and he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom set Amaziah over the army in place of Joab." Now Amaziah was the son of a man whose name was Jithrar, the Israelite, who went into Abigail, the daughter of Naash, sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. Now, I know this is really confusing here, but if you break it down and you look at what we were also told in Chronicles about this guy Amaziah, he is actually the son of David's sister Abigail, and he was apparently even illegitimate. And now Absalom is putting him in charge of his forces. And I think it's kind of significant as this. You see, the family members are at each other's throats. In other words, it reminds me very, very much of what Jesus had said in Matthew 10:32, when he said this. He says, "Everyone, therefore, who shall confess me before men, I also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever shall deny me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do you think that I came to bring peace on the earth? I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his own household." You know, you almost see this in David. David is so much of a prefigurement of Christ in so many ways. Even though he was a man with feet of clay and he made some horrendous mistakes in his life, you can still see a great deal, I think, of parallels and foreshadowing of Jesus in different ways. But you even see David's household, they're divided. And nothing's changed. I mean, when Jesus came upon the scene, I mean, he's the one that said, "Hey, I didn't come to bring peace to the world. I came to bring a sword." And it's going to be basically a conflict between right and wrong and good and evil and truth and error. And people are going to be split on it, especially with the Jewish family, because Jesus split those families and fragmented them to no end. Because if a Jewish person accepted Christ, even today, I mean, they are ostracized. And I even read of a guy who one time he accepted Christ, and his name is Michael Esses. I read one of his books. He said he accepted Jesus, and he was a Jew, and his whole family held a mock funeral. They actually had a coffin and everything, just buried it. As far as they were concerned, he was dead to them. And so you see a situation here where you've got loyalties that are split. But now keep this in mind, because I think this has a lot to say to us in terms of where we are at today. Because this is David's darkest hour, the darkest hour of his life in terms of what's happening to him. He's been run out of Jerusalem, run out of his palace, run out of his throne. He's on the run. And now it's coming down to a situation where he can really tell who his friends are. And he really can see who's really loyal to him. And I think this says a lot in terms of where we're at today. I mean, the darkness is going darker and darker by the day, spiritually speaking. It's just a fulfillment of what the Apostle Paul said. He said that in the last days there'll be apostasy. You know, the apostasy is a falling away. It's a defection from the truth, and that's going to open a door for the Antichrist eventually. And this darkness that's engulfing this planet, it's a spiritual darkness. And in the midst of this darkness, man, and people by the multitudes are forsaking Christ. They are becoming apathetic, lukewarm, indifferent. They are growing cold. And now's the time I really feel like, hey, man, Christians need to really suck it up, and they need to get serious with Christ in the midst of this cultural war, especially. And during this dark time that Jesus is, you know, I don't like to use the word he's on the run, but he's not here. He's not ruling and reigning. Right, he hasn't taken his throne yet. Well, it's obvious to him who's loyal and who's not. And, you know, this is where you see a situation where even in his own household is split against him. And this is in that verse 26 of chapter 17. I just want, just before we get into 18, look, go over that verse 26. It says, "And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. Now when David had come to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah, the sons of Ammon, Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodebar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogelim, brought beds and basins and potters and wheat and barley and flour and parched grain and beans and lentils and parched seeds, honey and curds for sheep, cheese for David and for the people who were with him to eat, for they said the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Now, the reason I even went over this again is because going into this chapter 18, you've got to see who's really, really putting their life on the line for David. Because all these people that are supporting David, they have no guarantee that David is going to be victorious. As a matter of fact, it looks like the tables are so turned on David that it looks like he's going to be defeated. And anybody who has supported him or given him any assistance or any help at all is going to be considered to be a traitor. They're going to be executed. There's no doubt about it. So people are putting their life on the line. A lot of people, they'll go along and get along with Christ as long as it's fashionable or as long as it's convenient or as long as it's they're just kind of opportunists that just feel like, well, this will be beneficial to me at this moment. But I'm telling you, people like the ones that are mentioned here and the ones he mentions here, the Shobai, the son of Nahash, he's an Ammonite. These used to be sworn enemies of David, and they're joining forces with him. And it says that this Machir from the son of Amiel from Lodebar. Remember what Lodebar means? Anybody remember?
Land of no pasture.
Yeah, it means land of no pasture. And here, this guy, I think it says a lot. I mean, just symbolically speaking, if we're not committed to Christ and sold out to Him, I don't care how rich or famous or powerful or influential we may be, you know what? We're just living in a land of no pasture because there's no future if we don't give our life to Christ. I mean, there's an old saying, there's one life will soon be passed, only that which is done for Christ will last. Well, here, these individuals really put their life on the line. And this guy here, he comes from a land of no pasture, but he's got a real future by throwing his lot in with David. And then, like I said before, when we were just finishing up this chapter last week, look at the things they just mentioned here. Beds and basins and pottery, wheat, barley, flowers, parched grain, beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey, curds, sheep, and cheese of the herd. And I almost feel like the Holy Spirit went to great lengths to just mention each one of these items rather than just simply saying, these men brought provisions for David. It could have easily said that, right? But they list everything that they bring. And it jumps out at me in terms of what Jesus had said. He says, hey, if you so much as give a cold glass of water to the least of my brethren in my name, it won't lose its reward. And God, it says in the Hebrews, is not unjust so as to forget the love that you show towards his name in ministering and continue to minister unto his saints. So it's kind of like God takes note of it. And nothing's going to go unnoticed or unrewarded in terms of what we do for him for his name's sake, especially, I think, in this time of darkness, because this is David's darkest hours, and people by the thousands are turning against him. And he only has a remnant that is sticking with him, and this remnant that's sticking with them, they are really sticking their necks out. Okay, I just wanted to read those last few verses, 17, before we get into 18, just so you can get the flow of what's taking place here. It says in that verse 1 of chapter 18 of 2 Samuel, it says, then David numbered the people who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David set the people out one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai, the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I myself will surely go out with you. Before we go any further, see what happened here? Remember the situation where when Absalom went into David's palace and then he asked Ahithophel for advice, and Ahithophel said, man, what you need to do is get 12,000 men right now. I'll lead them. David's on the run. He's weary. He's tired. Get him now. Get him while he's on the run. And, that was the best advice. But Hushai, David's friend, countered that advice, saying he really played upon Absalom's vanity. And he just says, hey, man, what you really need to do is marshal together the biggest force you can get of all Israel, and then you go out there and lead them. So what that did was it gave David time, right? And that's what he really needed, was time to get across the river, to get to Mahanaim, to get his forces together. Because by the time he got to Mahanaim, and I've shown you this on a map before, if you look at Jerusalem, he went from Jerusalem to Mahanaim. I mean, that was quite a trek. I mean, if you look at this map here, I mean, he went at least 50 miles. And especially crossing over the Jordan River. I mean, people were swimming across and they were ferrying across, and it took them a while to get across there, everybody that was with David. But by the time they got to Mahanaim, people from all around were now gathering to David around that area. And it's interesting, too. I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but right around that area in Mahanaim, if you remember Absalom, after he killed his brother Amnon, he went there because his grandfather lived there, and he went there and he stayed there two or three years. He was up there 3 years, I believe. And apparently, he didn't make an impression upon people there, because it looks like a lot of the people in that area there were coming to David's defense. So see what happened when Hushai gave the advice that he did to throw people off, to throw Absalom off? It gave David much needed time. So now he's in a situation where he's got thousands of people that are with him. He's still way outgunned, way outnumbered. But now he's dividing up his forces into three divisions or three companies, and each one is led by a different commander. But one of them is led by Joab, and the other one is led by Abishai. And both of those guys are brothers. Remember, they had the same mother, Zeruiah. But also, this Ittai is leading a command. And remember that Ittai, I think that says a lot, because this guy is a Philistine. He's from Gath. And again, it says something to me, spiritually speaking, because Philistines were obviously the sworn enemies of God's people, but here was a Gentile who committed himself to God, became a proselyte, and became one of David's most trusted warriors. And remember what Jesus said in the Gospel of John? He just said that, I have other sheep that are not of this fold, or not of this flock, and he was referring to the Gentiles. And I think it says a lot that you know, people that have thrown their lot in with Jesus Christ, who were once far from him and have become extremely loyal to him, I think you can see a great deal of spiritual significance to that as far as Ittai the Gittite. Anyway, in verse, well, that last part of verse 2, it says, and David said, I myself will surely go out with you. But now look what they say to David when David says, well, I'm going to go out to battle with you. This is what the people say. But the people said, you shall not go out, for if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000s of us. Therefore, now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, and all of the people went out by the hundreds and the thousands. Now, that to me is significant, too, because David is a seasoned warrior. I'm sure he's getting up in age, and he isn't what he used to be. But he's still, you know, willing to go out there and put his life on the line to defend his crown. And what are the people saying to him? Hey, man, you can't put yourself in anybody's crosshairs right here, because you are worth 10,000 of us. And it reminds me of, remember when Mary broke that alabaster of ointment and poured it upon Jesus, and Judas said, man, what a waste. This very expensive, costly perfume, which was worth a whole year's wage, could have been sold and given to the poor, the money given to the poor. And Jesus said, hey, man, leave this woman alone. He said, the poor you always have with you, but me, you won't always have with you. Mary saw the value of Christ. She saw the worth of Christ, even more so than his apostles, because even though Judas is the one that instigated, or he was the one that started this complaint as far as wasting this ointment on Jesus, it says that the other apostles joined in. They thought it was a waste too. And it was like they didn't have the depth, the insight, the discernment that Mary had as far as Jesus' worth. She was willing to waste this very, very, very expensive, costly perfume upon him. And I'm assuming now, this is speculative on my part, but I'm willing to bet that that perfume she had saved up for a long, long time. And she wanted to use it for a very special occasion. Probably she was thinking for her wedding or wedding night, or to save it for a special person in her life. I'm just assuming, but I bet you that's what it was she was saving it for. And then she just wasted the whole thing on Jesus. The whole thing. Not just a few drops. And why? Because she saw Jesus' worth. And I'm looking around and say, what's happening to people? They're failing to see Jesus' worth today. Now, I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but what I am saying is that, yeah, the love of many is growing cold because they don't see his value. Well, anyway, that beginning of that verse 5, it says, and the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Now, you know, look at David. In spite of what his son has done, and his son has proved himself to be such a wretch. I mean, his son is such a rebel. He's just a wicked, worthless, good-for-nothing. That's just the bottom line. I mean, this guy, Absalom, his character is so flawed in his rebellion against his father. This guy is just a wretch. But still, David loves him dearly and deeply, and he just doesn't want to see him executed. And I think it shows the heart of God in many respects, because even in spite of all of our sins and wretchedness, I mean, God is God of mercy. He wants to forgive, and he wants to reconcile, and he wants to show compassion. And at verse 6, it says, "And when the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim, and the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was great, 20,000 men, for the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured." And you know what? We don't even know where the forest of Ephraim is. I mean, if you look on this map here, you see Ephraim here, but the forest of Ephraim, I believe, was on the east side of the Jordan. So it was somewhere probably around 5 or 6 miles from Mahanaim, in that area there. But here's what's interesting, is that when the battle started, David's men were so seasoned, and they were so experienced, and they were so battle-hardened, they just really knew how to take this battle to these men, even though they were outnumbered. And then the terrain worked in their favor, because they put these guys on the run, and they killed 20,000 of them, and it says the forest devoured more of them. Now, I don't know if they were falling off cliffs, or they were getting injured, or getting killed somehow in all the thickets and all the underbrush or whatever, but I think it says a lot, because like in Jeremiah, it says something to the effect that you know, if you can't walk with a footman, how are you going to run with a horseman? You know, and if you fall in the open plain, what are you going to do in the Jordan thicket? And I think, you know, that has a powerful application when the prophet Jeremiah was asking, if you're stumbling and falling all over the place now, when your opportunities are ideal, what's going to happen to you when they're not ideal? And that's kind of reminded me of what Jesus said on the way to the cross. When the women were weeping for him, he looked at them and said, "Hey, don't weep for me, but weep for your children and your children's children." He said, because if they do this when the grass is green, what are they going to do when it's dry? I think what Jesus was referring to is this. He says, if they do this when the grass is green, in other words, they had such a prime opportunity to do the right thing, what are they going to do when the grass is dry? In other words, hey, he was pointing to the Antichrist. What are they going to do then? And I think, Kevin, you and I were talking the other night, or you were saying how you're witnessing some guy at work, and he was saying basically how he was a good person or whatever. And you just ran something by him. He says, yeah, you know, people are good, you know, as long as their circumstances are halfway satisfactory or something of that nature. But you turn your circumstances around and they become more and more of a dire circumstance, then the true nature of men begins to come out more and more. I kind of am rambling here, but I was just talking about how this forest devoured these people. I think it says something, because see, people's circumstances can defeat them. Like it said in Jeremiah, if they can't run with the footmen, how are they going to keep up with the horsemen? And if they fall in the open plain, what are they going to do in the Jordan jungle? You know, you knew when things are really tough. This is very interesting, because in verse 9 says, "Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going." Now, here's another interesting thing, is that Absalom, he sees David's men, and they're coming at him, and so he just hightails it out. But the problem is, he's in this forest of Ephraim, and he's trying to ride through the thickets. Now, this is the impression I get. And he's riding on his mule, and he's looking back. And so he's not watching where he's going. And he's looking back to see what's behind him. And just as he turns around, he gets his neck caught on a branch. And he ends up, his mule keeps going. So he's stuck there. It says here he's got caught by his head. But I think what's kind of interesting is that you know, I read the King James, the Modern Language, and the Revised Standard, and of course the New American Standard, and other Bibles. They all said he was caught by his head. The Living Bible said he was caught by his hair. And, you know, that's neither here nor there, but even in the book of Josephus, Josephus is a historian, a Jewish historian, he said this, "But David's men ran violently upon Absalom, for he was easily known by his beauty and his tallness, and he himself was also afraid lest his enemy should seize on him, so he got upon the king's mule and fled. But as he was carried with violence and noise," in other words, distracted with violence and noise, "and a great motion, as being light himself, he entangled his hair greatly in a large branch of a knotty tree that spread a great way, and there he hung after a surprising manner." So you know, I mean, that's neither here nor there, but sometimes I turn to this book of Josephus, because he's a Jewish historian who gives it a little bit more light. He says that he ends up getting hung by his hair. I get this impression. What happened was that he turned around to see all the commotion behind him, and as he turned back to face frontward, he got caught between oak branches, and his head got caught. His mule kept going. And when he tried to untangle himself or get out from under this branch, his hair apparently got all tangled up and all knotted up in all of these knotty branches. I mean, I have oak trees out here, and believe me, they can really get knotted up to where, you know, it's very, very difficult to break them up. And I think that's kind of significant, because, you know, we're told about Absalom's hair. Remember we read in chapter 14 where it says about his hair, that every year he would cut his hair, and his hair would weigh approximately 3 pounds, a little more than 3 pounds. And this guy, we're told that, I mean, he was just a very vain person. His outward beauty is where a lot of people look to him as being such a great guy. And his inward soul, his character was so flawed. I mean, he was nothing but a monster of iniquity. But outwardly, this guy looked so appealing. Well, his hair became a snare to him. It became his undoing, because that, I think, symbolized his arrogance, symbolized his pride, symbolized, you know, everything that was so important to him. That he was going to, you know, try to overthrow his own father and become king. That's how I think he thought of himself. He was so important. Well, that became a snare to him. And I think that anything that we put above God, it eventually becomes a snare to us. It's eventually going to be our undoing. And that's exactly what happened to him, because once he's got stuck in that oak tree, he's hanging there. It says he's hanging between heaven and earth. I mean, his mule just kept running, and now he's swaying back and forth. I guess he was trying to get his neck off of this branch, but his hair is all tangled up on these knotted branches. Then it says here, and at verse 10, it says, when a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. And Joab said to the man who had told him, now, behold, you saw him. Why then you did not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. And the man said to Joab, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect for me the young man Absalom. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. Then Joab said, I will not waste time here with you. So he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. Now, here Absalom is. He's hanging between heaven and earth by his hair. This became his undoing. It became the snare. And actually, you know, ended up taking his life or being the cause of his death. But here's an interesting thing. I hope I don't make too much of a mental leap here, but when did Jesus hang between heaven and earth?
He was on the cross.
On the cross, right? And Jesus said to Nicodemus, he says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. All right? Here Jesus is hanging between heaven and earth on a cross. And because of his self-sacrifice, he draws men to himself. Look at the contrast between Absalom. You know, he's totally absorbed in himself. He wants to draw all men to himself, but all he's drawn to himself is what? A hard time, a bad time, you know, the end of his life. And I think that that's instructive in the sense that, hey, if we're going to exalt ourselves rather than Christ, what's going to be the end result? It's just going to be a hard time. It says here in that verse 16, it says, then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. In other words, they called up the fight. Once Absalom was killed, it says, no point in fighting anymore because, you know, the battle's over. And in verse 17, then they took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in the forest and erected over him a very great heap of stones. And all of Israel fled to his tent. Look at it. They heaped up on him a bunch of stones. And we're going to be reading just a little bit further down that there was a time in Absalom's life when he, before he had children, that he erected a monument to himself. Well, this guy was so vain. I mean, he craved the power, the attention, the influence, the prestige, the accolades of people. I mean, his whole universe just revolved around his ego. And he even ends up building a monument to himself to draw attention to himself. But look at his final monument. It's what? He has a heap of stones. It's almost like Achan, who was stoned to death and then buried under a pile of stones. And this was his end. He met an ignominious defeat. And you can see people today who are just God haters. I mean, God haters. I mean, they won't come out and tell you, well, I'm a God hater. You know, very few of those people will do that. But I'm telling you, man, any so-called atheist, hey, they're a God hater. You know, it's not that they don't believe in God. They know deep down in their gut, in their soul, in their heart, there's a God. They just hate him. They can't stomach the thought of him. They can't stomach submitting to his lordship, to his kingship. You know, they are going to revolt against that. But look what's going to happen to them. And then it says, and all Israel fled each to his tent. In other words, even that's instructive. I mean, this is what's going to happen to people, that if they're not going to throw their lot in with Christ, they're going to be put on the run. What's going to happen when Jesus Christ comes back? He says, when he comes back, a great power, great glory. And every eye is going to see him. You're going to have two classes of people, and only two classes of people. You're going to have the class of people who have committed their lives to Christ, see him coming, and they'll have tears of joy in their eyes, and they'll just be praising God, saying, hallelujah, here he comes, finally he's coming. And they're going to be ecstatic to see him coming. And then the other class of people, they're going to look at him and says, they're going to turn to the rocks and the hills and the mountains. They're going to say, fall upon us and, you know, hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. I mean, you know, that's the only two people you're going to have. These people run their tents. They're going to hide. Well, that's what's going to happen to people when Christ returns. You're either going to be, you know, cheering his second coming, or you're going to be trying to find some crack, some crevice, some hole in this universe and slip into and become non-existent out of sheer terror because of your treachery. And then it says here in that verse 18, it says, now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to preserve my name. So he named the pillar after his own name, and it's called Absalom's Monument to this day. That's what I was talking about here. But remember, when we went through chapter 14, I think it was verse 27, we are told that he had three sons and one daughter. Now this isn't a contradiction. You know, I know all of the people who try to always tear apart the Bible, they're going to say, well, here's a contradiction here. It says he didn't have any sons or daughters. But just read what it says and put it all together in that verse 18. Now, in Absalom's lifetime, he had taken and set up a pillar. So, in other words, he set up this monument before he had children, thinking that, well, in case I don't have any heirs, I want to always have something to immortalize myself, right? And then he says in verse 19, he says, then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies. But Joab said to him, you are not the man to carry the news this day, but you shall carry the news another day. However, you shall carry no news today because the king's son is dead. Now, remember who Ahimaaz is? Him and Jonathan were sons of the priests, and they were the young boys who acted as go-between, as messengers, as spies, because when Hushai was able to get the message to them through a young girl, and told Ahimaaz and Jonathan what was going to happen and to get the message to David to cross over the fords of the Jordan before it was too late. Well, Ahimaaz and Jonathan, they went off running to tell David, but I guess a young girl had seen them and reported it to Absalom, so they were running for their lives. And they ran into this one yard where this woman knew them, and she hid them in a dried-out well, and by putting over a cloth over the mouth of the well and putting some grain on top of it, and she hid them. And then when the soldiers had left, then she got them out of the well, and these guys ran to David to tell him what to do by the advice of Hushai. So Ahimaaz, he's a young kid. He's probably 18, 19 or whatever, but he's loyal to David. He wants to go run and tell David the news. But Joab says, no, you're not going to run today. You're not going to be the messenger. And the reason why he didn't want him to go is because he's the priest's son, and he didn't want to have him break the bad news as far as his son Absalom, because David gave specific orders, hey, you know, be merciful to him and for my sake. Well, instead, he says, you can't run. But what's interesting, look at that verse 21. Then Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you have seen. So the Cushite bowed to Joab and ran. Now, the Cushite, if you look on a map, and you find Cush on a map, it's right there at the northern tip of Ethiopia, which suggests to me that the Cushite was a black man. All right, so Joab tells him, hey, you go run to David. All right, I don't want this young kid going telling him this bad news, but you tell him. But then in verse 22, it says, then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said once more to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, "Why would you run, my son, since you will have no reward for going? But whatever happens," he said, "I will run." So he said to him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and passed up the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall and raised his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running by himself. And the watchman called out and told the king, and the king said, "If he is by himself, there is good news in his mouth." And he came nearer and nearer. Now, why would David say that? Why would David say, "Well, if he's by himself, there's good news"? Why would he interpret that to be good news if he sees one runner by himself? Okay, just think this through. Why do you think it would be? Well, put it this way. If they were defeated in battle, what you would be seeing is you'd be seeing people running in groups, 10s and 20s and 50s and 100s, right? And coming back by the thousands. In other words, being routed, right? But if you only see one person, then he figures, well, if it's just one person, then they're not on the run. They're not defeated. They're not fleeing in battle. So the news has got to be good. So he kind of puts that together. And then, but what's kind of interesting, if you read a little bit further down, it says in verse 26, "Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and says, 'Behold, another man is running by himself.' And the king said, 'This one also is bringing good news.' And the watchman said, 'I think that running is that of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zodak.' And the king said, 'This is a good man and comes with good news.'" Now, you know, I don't want to make too much of a mental leap here, but remember when we read in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 9, 24, that Paul said that this is a race. As a matter of fact, maybe I should just read what he says there, because I think it's kind of instructive. And he says, "Do you not know that those who run a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. Then they do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an unperishable, or an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I buffet my body and make it a slave, least possibly after I have preached to others, I myself should be found disqualified." So, you know, here's the thing. When we're reading this, like I said, this guy who's running, Ahimaaz, he's seen running from afar, and what do they say about him? It says here that he could detect who he is by his running. Look at that, verse 27. "And the watchman said, 'I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zodak.'" And in a sense, it says something about us in this race, right? I mean, Paul says it's a race, and we are to run the race in such a way as to win, right? And I think the way we run this race says a lot about us. And other people can detect who we are by how we run. It was Jesus who said, "By the fruits you shall know them," right? And if we're running in such a way that we produce the type of fruit that can be seen as glorifying God, then, you know, it shows how we're running this race. But the other side of the coin is Jesus said, "Hey, a good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree can't bear good fruit." And if you claim to be a Christian, but you're not running this race, or you're not running the way you're supposed to run, that says a lot about you too. So anyway, this it says here in that verse 26, "Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and says, 'Behold, another man running by himself.' The king said, 'This is also bringing good news.' And the watchman said, 'I think it's the running of the first one. It's like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zodak.' And the king said, 'This is a good man and comes with good news.' And Ahimaaz called and said to the king, 'All was well.' And he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And he said, 'Blessed is the Lord our God, who has delivered up the men who lifted their hands up against the Lord my king.' And the king said, 'Is it well with the young man Absalom?' And Ahimaaz answered, 'When Joab sent the king's servant and your servant and I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was.' Then the king said, 'Turn aside and stand here.' So he turned aside and stood still." Now, this is speculative on my part, but I'm just going to ask a question. Why do you think Ahimaaz wanted so desperately to run? In other words, Joab gave him permission to run after the Cushite. The Cushite took off first, and then Ahimaaz kept pleading his case, and Joab says, "Okay, go ahead and run." Well, it appears that Ahimaaz took the long way, but he took the easier way. He took the by the way of the plain. So the Cushite was running the shorter way, but his way, I guess, was to hit the train that he had to go on was kind of treacherous, and even though it was shorter, it took him longer. Ahimaaz, even though he went the longer way, he got there first. But why do you think he wanted to get there so badly? And get there first.
To give good news to the king?
Well, I think this. They both had good news to give. This is speculative on my part. But I see, when he asked about his son's Absalom, he didn't tell him, right? He just said, well, there's a great commotion, and I don't know exactly what happened. So David said, well, stand aside here, and we'll hear what this other runner has to say.
Might lessen the blow.
There it is. He wanted to be there when David received this blow. He wanted to be there as somebody there to console him, to comfort him, to encourage him, to be there for him. I get that impression that you see that this Ahimaaz really had a heart for David in terms of a real concern, a real sensitivity, and he wanted to be there to comfort David in his bad news because he knew what was coming. Because he didn't tell him the bad news, but he wanted to be there when the bad news was told. There's another sign, I think, of a close friend. The Bible says there's a friend that sticks closer than a brother. A true friend is going to be one that's there in need. And anyway, in verse 30, he says, then the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still, and behold, the Cushite arrived. And the Cushite said, let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up the chamber over the gate and wept. Thus he said as he walked, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I have died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Now, this says a lot about David. Like, you know, I said, David is so much of a prefigurement of Christ. Now, look at this wretched Absalom. I mean, he was really, really a wicked person. No question about it. But David loved him deeply, and David just says, oh, I wish I had died instead of you. Now, what does this show you? And as far as Christ is concerned, you see the heart of Christ. In other words, you know, we are just wretched, miserable sinners, but it says a great deal in terms of the way God feels about anybody being lost. Because what does it say in that? I think in Ezekiel chapter 33, God says, hey, as I live, declares the Lord, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. But I would rather that he repent and turn from his wicked ways, right? When a soul goes to hell, I mean, God doesn't, you know, rub his hands together in glee and figure, well, now he's finally got his up and comers. No, he's really, really grieved over that. When a person gets his just hands. Anybody even want to add or share to that chapter? Because we've got about 15 minutes. I'd just like to quickly go through this 19, and then we'll go ahead and close tonight. But it says here in that verse 1, it says, then it was told Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it and said that day, the king is grieved for his son. So the people went by stealth into the city that day as the people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. And the king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab came into the house of the king and said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants. Who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, that you would be pleased. Now therefore arise and go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. So the king arose and sat at the gate, and when they told all the people, saying, behold, the king is sitting at the gate, then all the people came before the king. Now all of Israel had fled east to his tent. That's the second time we've read that verse, right? All of Israel fled to their tent. It's almost put there for emphasis. He already said it once, but he says it again. It's like, in the end, every knee is going to bend, every tongue is going to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord in heaven, on earth, and under the earth. But here's the thing. It's kind of like now is the time to throw in your lot with Christ. Just like with, you know, in David's darkest hour, that was the time to throw in your lot with him. Because everybody that threw in their lot with the wrong crowd is what? They're going to be fleeing, right? And hiding at the very end. But David, he's just a man. He's a man with feet of clay. He's, you know, very, very distraught here. And he's not thinking clearly because, obviously, Joab, who isn't half the man that David is spiritually, has to go and rebuke David and set David right. He says, hey, man, you better get out there and thank these people and address these people and show your appreciation to these people, or I guarantee you nobody's going to spend a night with you, man. And then you're really going to have some problems on your hands. And David saw, you know, obviously the wisdom of that, but he was so emotionally distraught, I don't think that he was thinking clearly. He was just so tore up about his son Absalom. And like I said, I think that you can almost see the heart of God there, where what happens? It's like, you know, Jesus is the one that gave the parable of the 100 sheep, right? The 99 that didn't need attention, and the one that did, and the shepherd goes out there and risks everything to save the lost one, showing the heart of God that he has such deep love and concern on the least, the last, and the lost. But anyway, Joab sets David right, so David goes out there to speak to the people. And then in verse 9 says, "And all the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back?'" Now, I get the impression that, remember when David, he fled to Mahanaim, which is about 50 miles away from Jerusalem, he's probably been there for weeks, maybe even a couple months. And even though now the battle has been won, he's still there, and people are saying, "Hey man, what we need to do is go bring him back to Jerusalem." And so they're kind of figuring, even though we threw our lot in with the wrong crowd here, it's time that we just set things right and go get him. And that verse 10 again, "However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle." You know, that's the thing. Whoever we put in the place of Christ is going to come to a dead end. "Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back?" Then the king David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, 'Why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of Israel has come to the king, even to this house?'" In other words, I guess David was getting word that Israel wanted to bring him back, but he hadn't heard from his own tribe, Judah. So he sent to the priest and said, "Hey, speak to them," because even Judah had turned on him. So he wanted these people to bring him back. David wasn't just going to, after the battle, just him and his men just go marching back in Jerusalem, because he knew that a lot of people in Jerusalem, a lot of people in Judah, and of course all of the northern tribes, so many people, they threw their lot in with Absalom. So, you know, he just felt like the only way he could really go back was if people were to take him back. And that's what he's asking him to do. Verse 12 says, "You are my brothers and you are my bone of my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amaziah, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more so if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab." Now, Amaziah, remember who he is? He's kind of like, I guess, a nephew of David, because he was apparently the son of an Ishmaelite, Jether, and he apparently was illegitimate, and he was the son of Abigail, one of David's sisters. And so he was a sworn enemy of David when he became the commander-in-chief of Absalom's army. But David saw that he probably could probably mend a lot of bad blood as far as the people were concerned if he made Amaziah his commander-in-chief. So he decided to do that because Amaziah was the one that was leading his enemies. So he figured, well, if I get Amaziah on my side, then a lot of people will follow him, and there could be a reconciliation here that could mend this rift. Well, we're reading here that he made Amaziah his commander-in-chief, and why do you think he did that instead of Joab anymore?
He knew Joab had something to do with the death of his son, and that was kind of like the last straw.
Yeah, Joab again and again showed himself to be just a murderous person, and it was kind of like a punishment. Basically, David was saying, okay, you're demoted, man. You're no longer going to be my commander-in-chief. You didn't follow my instructions, so he's going to make Amaziah commander-in-chief instead. And it was a political move, but we're going to read in the next chapter, but we're not going to get into it tonight, but it was a bad move. Anyway, he says here in that verse 14, he says, "Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man. So they sent word to the king, saying, 'Return, you and all your servants.' The king then returned and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to go meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. And Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, who was from Beruim hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him. And they rushed to the Jordan before the king. And they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household and to do what was good in his sight. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, "Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong in the day when my lord the king came out from the Jerusalem, so that the king should take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the household of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king." And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, "Should not Shimei be put to death for this, because he has cursed the Lord's anointed?" And David said, "What do I have to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am king over Israel today?" And the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." Thus the king swore to him. Now, remember Shimei? When David was on the run, he was fleeing. Him and his whole household and all of his bodyguards and everybody else that was with him was fleeing Jerusalem. And they were going up the Mount of Olives, and barefoot and weeping. And then on their way, on that long trek to Mahanaim, Shimei was from the household of Saul, from the tribe of Benjamin, which was Benjamin was the tribe of Saul. He was just cursing David and cursing him and throwing things at him and throwing things at his men. And he was just going right along with them. I get the impression they're all going along. He's probably on higher ground on a levee or something, and he's just cursing them the whole way. And the Bible does say, you know, "You shall not curse a ruler of your people." All right, I mean, it was a capital offense, and this guy was just cursing David left and right. And now David says to him, "Okay, I'm king today, and nobody's going to put you to death." But we read in 1 Kings, I think it's chapter 1, if I'm not mistaken, when we get into the 1 Kings, that when David is on his deathbed, he tells his son Solomon, "Hey, Shimei cursed me with a violent curse when I was running from your brother Absalom." And he says, "Make sure that his gray hair doesn't go down in peace to the grave." Now, David wasn't coming back on his word, but what did David see in Shimei that he knew that he could never be trusted?
Just the volatility, that going which way the winds blow is positive.
You could just see it. You could see it in the guy, that if Absalom had become king instead of David retaining his kingship, he would have been delighted. David knew that. In other words, he really didn't have a broken, contrite spirit and just say, "You know what, I really, really, really am sorry that I've thrown my lot in with this wretched Absalom. It was the worst, most terrible mistake of my life. I deserve to die. I just don't know how I can make it up to you, but I am dead serious." But, you know, David just knew, no, this guy's heart has not been turned. It has not been changed. This guy's just trying to save his hiney. And this guy, given the slightest chance, he will turn on me again. David just knew his heart. In other words, if somebody else came along and led a revolt against David, he'd throw in his lot with them too. David just knew it. Guy couldn't be trusted, right? Nevertheless, what does David do? He shows mercy to him. And I think that this is what you see in Christ too. He shows mercy to people that just absolutely hate him. People who just kind of are just going to serve God just out of fear of punishment. And they'll turn on them the first chance they get if they think they can get away with it. Well, that's no commitment. That's no loyalty. That's no friendship. And David knew it, that this guy could not be trusted. And nevertheless, he shows him this mercy. But, you know, had the guy not come to David, he obviously would have been executed as a traitor. Anyway, now verse 24, we're just winding this down. It says, "Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day that the king departed until the day he came home in peace. And it was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, 'Why did you not go down with me, Mephibosheth?' And he answered, 'O my lord the king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go down with the king, because your servant is lame. Moreover, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like an angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your sight. for all my father's household were nothing but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king?" So the king said to him, "Why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land." And Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house." Now, remember this Mephibosheth? Remember what Ziba said about him? When Ziba met David with a lot of provisions, when David was on the run, and David said, "Well, where's Mephibosheth?" And because Ziba was basically put in charge of him. And he said, "Well, he figured that now that you were on the run, it was kind of opened the door for him to maybe become king." Because remember, he's the last surviving heir. As far as Saul was concerned, he's the son of Jonathan. And there's a possibility that he might be able to become king in the midst of all of this political upheaval. Well, you get a situation here where now you got two sides of the story. But David, instead of saying, "You know, I believe you, I'm going to give all the land back to you," he only gives him half the land. What does that suggest to you?
I'm not sure which one's telling the truth.
I think he probably says, "You know what? I think neither Ziba nor Mephibosheth is telling the whole truth here, or the truth lies somewhere in between." In other words, even though Mephibosheth was lame, what indicates to you that he could have still followed David?
Still had animals to ride.
Well, in other words, he goes out to meet David at the Jordan, right? On a donkey. So if he could do that, he could have followed David. Now, here's the thing. He would have been nothing but dead weight to David. Nothing but dead weight. Because the guy's lame in both feet. But it was important to David, very, very important to David, that Mephibosheth, that he follow him. Why do you think it was so important to him? Right, because he was the only surviving potential heir to the throne of Saul, right? So if Mephibosheth, were to throw in his lot with David to show everybody very graphically, "Hey man, I'm giving my 100% support behind David," that would have shown people, you know what, that's where his loyalty is. And he's not an opportunist looking for an opportunity to take advantage of this situation. And it could have been a lot to David, because other men of Benjamin would have said, "You know what, if Mephibosheth throws in his lot with David, then we ought to too." Right? Because Saul was from Benjamin and Jonathan was from Benjamin. And if Mephibosheth had done that, it would have meant a lot to him. You see, I think this happens to people, you know, as far as Christ is concerned, they become opportunists. And I think that this is what this Mephibosheth was. I think that he just felt like, well, if I stay here, you know, Absalom will probably spare my life. If I run with David, he looks like he's not going to win this battle, then I'm going to lose my life too. See what I'm saying? He sat on the fence. He sat on the sidelines. And I think that says a lot in terms of a person's loyalty. So what happened to the guy? David still says he can eat at my table, but he suffers a great loss in terms of his reputation, in terms of even his possessions. If people are just opportunists, they're not going to throw their lot in with Jesus Christ, what's going to be the end result? They're going to have little or nothing to show for it at the end. Now, here's one thing before we just close this down. You know, the old saying, where there's a will, there's a way. All right? I don't know how many times I've heard a lame excuse, for example, where people say to me, "Well, you know what? I don't go to church on Sunday because I have to work." And I just flat out tell people, "You know what? I'll bet you if your minister said, 'I'm going to give $500 to everybody who shows up to church today,' I'll bet you'd be there." And I say, "Well, yeah, I'll be there, right?" Well, they're like Mephibosheth, right? Mephibosheth was lame in his both his feet, but he gives these lame excuses as far as I can see. And I think that's what David saw too. He figured, "Well, you're riding a donkey now. Why couldn't you ride it then?" Right? I think David just figured, this guy's not just lame physically, he's giving me a lame excuse. And people come up with lame excuses of why they can't go to church, or why don't they go to Bible study, why don't they go to prayer group, why don't they do this and why don't they do that. I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but I do think that there's a message here for people who always come up with one lame excuse after another why they didn't totally throw their lot in with Christ. Or, you know, they're just kind of opportunists, or just too lazy, apathetic, indifferent, whatever. And this last one, verse 31, says, "Now Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogelim, and he went on to to the Jordan with the king to escort him over the Jordan. Now, presumably, I was very old, being 80 years old, and he had sustained the king while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. And the king said to Barzillai, "You cross over with me, and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me." But Barzillai said to the king, "How long have I yet to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am now 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good and bad? Or can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Or can I hear any more of the voice of singing men and women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. However, here is your servant Chimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what is good in your sight." And the king answered Chimham, "Cross over with me and I will do for him what is good in your sight, and whatever you require of me, I will do for you." This Barzillai, just in passing, he was the one that met David with all kinds of provisions. He's an old man, but he threw his lot in with David, knowing darn well that if David was executed, was killed, that he was going to be executed as a traitor too. But, you know, we're told in Psalms, we're told that 70 years are given man because of strength. Some may live to be 80. Here this Barzillai, he's basically at the end of his life, but he's doing all of this stuff for David. And, you know, remember what David said in Psalm 92, where he said, "The righteous man will flourish like a palm tree, and he will grow like a cedar in Lebanon, planted in the house of the Lord. They will flourish in the courts of our God, and they will still yield fruit in old age. They shall be full of sap and very green." In other words, you know, Barzillai, he was an old man, but he was really a tremendous asset to David in his darkest hour, in his time of need, wasn't he? And I've been in and out of old folks' home, and where people are just basically warehoused. And what do you see? You see so many of these people standing at death's door. They're at the threshold of the grave. And they're just staring at blankly at a wall or a TV set or off into space. And they're slouched over in a chair, and they're just waiting to die. And I think, you know, the Bible says here that if you really let your roots sink deep down into God, into Christ, then you'll be full of sap, and even in old age, even if your health has failed you, you'll still be productive, you'll still be fruitful. I don't care if you're laying on your back in a sick bed, you'll still be praying, you'll still be doing something for the honor and glory of God, to be fruitful, like this Barzillai. But Barzillai said, "I'm too old, I'm not going to be able to be a good counselor to you or anything else, because I'm just beyond usefulness." He says, "But here's my son, Chimham." We know that his son later on, but he says, "Take him." So he takes him, and you know, just in passing, the Bible does say in Proverbs, it says, "The glory of sons is their fathers, and the crown of old men is their grandchildren." But you know, he says, "The glory of sons is their fathers." You'd almost think it'd be just the opposite, right? You'd almost think the glory of fathers is their sons, but the Bible says the glory of sons is their fathers. Why does it put it that way?
Fathers that train their son well to show
what he's done. About 80% or more of the guys in prison today don't have a father. Their father has abdicated them, or they're illegitimate, or whatever the situation is. Well, if you've got a father that really raises up his son in love and knowledge and fear of God, and really, really invests his life into his son, then that's the glory of the son. The son is going to reap a tremendous legacy from the father. And I think that that's what you see in this Chimham, because he had such a godly father that he is really, really blessed. Anyway, in verse 39 says, "Then all the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too, and the king then kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his place. Now the king went to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel accompanying the king. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and David's men with him over the Jordan?' Then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is a close relative to us. Why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten all that the king's expenses, or has anything been taken for us?' But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 parts in the king, therefore we also have more claim to David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king?' Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel." Now, I just want to close this tonight by reading just a couple of verses in chapter 20, because, you know, that's not a good place to break this up, because it says there in verse 1 of chapter 20, "Now the worthless fellow happened to be there, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, Benjaminite, and he blew his trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, nor do we have an inheritance of the sons of Jesse, every man to his tents, O Israel. So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan, even to Jerusalem. Now, just closing in this, I think it's kind of significant. Is that, you know, you get a situation where you got the 10 tribes going down to Jordan to get David to bring him back, and you got Judah coming down there, and they get in a fight with one another. And they're saying, how come you guys didn't call us? In other words, Judah went up there to bring him back, and then the 10 tribes, people from the 10 tribes, they're mad at Judah because they didn't call them. And so they get in the biggest argument, and then this guy named Sheba blows his trumpet and says, hey, what do we have to do with David? Forget it. So the 10 tribes take off, and Judah's left there, and Judah takes him back to Jerusalem. But, you know, that says a lot to me in this respect. You see, the people's hearts aren't really for David. I don't know how many times I've seen this or heard this or read about this, but a number of you probably have seen it yourself. Ever talk to a person, try to witness a person, and they will say something to the effect of, well, you know what, I was in the choir once, and I was doing this in the church once, and, you know, I don't really feel like I was really appreciated, so I just said the heck with it and I left. You ever hear something like that from people?
Yes.
Yeah. I've heard it a number of times over the years. Well, what does that say to you about these people?
That they weren't really interested in Christ.
Yeah, they're not really...
They have the heart of a servant.
Right.
We're looking to be entertained.
Right. It's like they're there and they feel like, hey, I'm not being appreciated the way I need to be appreciated. You know what I'm saying? I'm sitting here and I'm doing this, that, and the other thing in this church, and I'm not giving the kind of recognition that I feel like I deserve. So the heck with this. I'm just not going to church anymore. Well, what does that tell you about these people? They're not there to glorify Christ. They're not there to uplift him. They're not there to put him on the throne and to glorify him.
And the church is better off without him.
Well, I'm just saying, what do we see here? We see that kind of similarity, right, in this type of attitude. They just feel like, hey, if they were really concerned about David, it wouldn't have mattered to them whether they were called first or they were the first ones there or they were getting all the credit or the recognition. What would have mattered to them is, hey, man, we need to put you back where you belong, in the palace and on your throne and in charge. But no, because they get slighted. They say, well, I'm not having anything to do with this. And they all blow the trumpet and take off, right? What does that say about their loyalty? What does that say about their real commitment? It's not there. It's phony. It's self-serving. And that you find that a lot in the church today. I've seen it a lot where people say, I don't go to church anymore because this person did that and that person did this and they did this. What has that got to do with anything? Man, it's like John the Baptist would say about Christ. He says, I must decrease while he must increase. And that's got to be our attitude. And if we don't have an attitude like this, we're going to end up being like this Sheba and the rest of his gang, right? Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Well,